Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 151, which is another one of my fun episodes that I did at THU. Actually, as many of you know, I did a bunch of interviews for THU TV while I was there, and I got to pick a lot of my guests, including these amazing guests. And I took two of these interviews and combined them into one. So it's one of those double episodes. The first half is Jeff Muddle and Keely Kolklu. Jeff has been on before, as you guys know. He's one of the founder of CG Architect, great ArcViz site. And Keely Kolklu, who's also been a guest in the past, she was also a speaker this year at THU. She is the founder of Kilograph, a fantastic ArcViz company based here in Los Angeles. But her background also happens to have some visual effects in it. She was working over at PLF, which is Pixel Liberation Front, and she did some amazing previs for movies like Iron Man and etc. And we talk about the passion that architects have for film and feel that, you know, architects and film have a huge relationship together, which I think is really cool, and thinking about how to express architecture and narrative. So that was a really great conversation. And one of the things I love about what I do in terms of this podcast is the fact that I get to meet all kinds of interesting people. And what I've discovered over time is that every single person out there has an incredible story without knowing that they have an incredible story to tell. Jessica Rudzovich is the second person on this, and she is amazing. I met her through Rory Robinson. And she came with him, and she was sort of just an attendee, you know, hanging out at the conference. And I started talking about some of the stuff that she does, and it's fascinating. And I really thought she should be part of the podcast. And she's like, "What would I say?" I said, "Just you wait." So just to give you a little bit of a teaser, she is an experience designer, which a lot of people may know user experience or what that means in terms of creating something on a computer. But she creates an experience for everything, not just for computers, and designs how people travel through things and how they experience things. Fascinating, fascinating field. And I just, all I can say is listen to Jessica's input on how to design experiences, and you will realize very quickly that it's going to be a very critical part of everything we do, from films to VR to architecture to everything. So really, really, really great chat with her. Before I move on, as you guys know, I've been trying to incentivize people to get on to iTunes and to post more. People have been doing that, and I appreciate it. I am going to go ahead and read some reviews as a way to incentivize you to do that more. And we got a really great review today from someone named Sina GH. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly. That's what his sign-off is on iTunes. And that's really where I want people to go. If they can go to iTunes and give us a rating and possibly write a review, that would be really helpful for us, because we're trying to see if we can get more exposure on iTunes specifically. But anyway, Sina writes, "Hi. You hear me from Iran, which is great. We're reaching out all over the world. It's wonderful. I have been listening to this podcast from the beginning. We need to hear more about this, about CG to learn, and the CG Garage is a good start. I would be good if you can tell me your opinion on other podcasts that are helpful for CG artists." Well, see, now let me tell you a couple other ones that I think are really cool. I think that Alan McKay has a really fun podcast. That one's very interesting. It's different than my approach, which mine is just hanging out and chatting with people of all kinds of different subjects. Alan is a lot more focused about people's careers and how to advance your career and how to make yourself a valuable asset in the CG industry. And I think that one's a really cool one. Some of the other ones, which is a much more sort of related to behind the scenes and a little much more journalistic style, is all the podcasts you would get from FX Guide. Those are really fun. I actually really like the VFX show. It's cool. They sort of talk about a movie that they like or don't like in some cases. And it's a really cool one to listen to. So go ahead and check those out. Those are really cool. Anyway, so Sina goes on, "Your podcast is perfect, and thank you for bringing it to us. By the way, I know that you have a wide range of listeners, but I would love to hear more deep, geeky stuff about rendering and lighting. We appreciate your effort and time." Thanks a lot, Sina. I appreciate that. Yeah, sure. I will try to bring a little bit more technical stuff to it, but keep in mind that I have some really great resources on technical stuff on the Chaos Group page itself. So if you go to chaosgroup.com and go to the blog section in there, I write some blogs about some new technology that we're developing. For example, in V-Ray, and I'll be doing a whole bunch of them because we're going to be gearing up for a new version of V-Ray in the very near future, and I'll be writing blog posts about some of these new features and what they're all about. So go to chaoscoop.com and go to the blog section and look there for some new blog posts coming up about some new technology. All right, guys, hopefully you'll enjoy this great podcast with Jeff Muddle, Keely Koklu, and Jessica Rutsevich.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Today, I'm joined by Keely and Jeff, good friends of mine. Jeff and I have known each other for about 16 years.
Yeah, about that.
And believe it or not, Keely and I have known each other for about 20 years, but we didn't realize it. Because I was, you were a student of mine at Rice University.
Yes. This is many years ago.
But the reason I wanted to bring you guys on is specifically to talk about architecture. And this happened last year. Jeff came on to this to THU and inspired us to do something. So Jeff, why don't you tell us the story about why you came to THU last year and then how this conversation happened?
Yeah. So I mean, you know, I mean, I go to a ton of events, but always generally within our own industry in the architectural biz industry. But I'd heard so many.
But
good...
also, you go to SIGGRAPH. And
yeah, of course. I mean, there are sort of crossover events as well. Right. But you know, I knew you were coming to this event. And I think there's one or two others that I knew, and I was hearing really good things. And to be honest, I mean, I don't come from the concept art and, you know, the VFX and game side. So, but I was interested in why this event was so successful, because it was really rarely hugely
right.
successful. So I came, and the first couple days, I was like, wow, this is interesting. And by day three or four, I mean, I completely drank the Kool-Aid, and like I'm like complete tribe member now.
Right.
I mean, I came back this year just because I was so inspired. I mean, honestly, in 21 years of going to events, this was the most inspiring event, hands down, I've ever been to.
Right, I agree. And I remember you, day one, and you came here and you says, Chris, you have a lot to live up to, because you talk about this like it's the most amazing thing
yeah.
ever. And you says, you have a lot to live up to. It's like, I am fully confident that you are going to enjoy
right.
this, and not that I've oversold it at all.
Yeah.
And I think, hopefully I did. The thing is that you really have to experience it to understand it. But one of the big conversations we had was about architecture. And architecture visualization, and how that field, which was Keely is involved in as well, and we'll get to Keely from why she's here, but that field specifically lacks inspiration.
Yeah.
It's mostly focused on technology and about your settings and tutorials or whatever. There's no real feeling of inspiration that this event brings.
Yeah, I agree.
And so you put out something on Facebook about it during the event
yeah.
to specifically address that.
Yeah, I mean, our industry kind of is born of technology, even though there are a lot of artists and they come from an architectural background.
Right.
It's interesting. We focus almost exclusively online in on the technology side, and we rarely talk about the artistic side. So,
right.
I mean, I had been here for 3 or 4 days, I guess, and I had been seeing all these really inspirational artistic talks, and then I had gone to one of the more technical talks here, and it just hit me like a ton of bricks. It was like this, you know, the contrast, and it was like, wow. And I had made a post because it was almost an emotional experience when I hit it, and I commented on how our industry really needs to focus on the core of why we do what we do.
Right.
You know, no client comes to us and goes, oh, you know, Kilograph does the best ambient occlusion shader in architecture, so you know that's why we hire them.
I mean,
right?
No so, one hired Kilograph because they're ambient occlusion.
Right.
Not,
so,
not
so I was like, why? You know, why do we not talk about right. why we actually exist? So, I mean, it was.
Well, to make the long story short, basically, we convinced Andre that we want to do this. We want to bring architecture here, and we want to bring the subject of architecture. And so, we brought Keely, who's an amazing person, and tell us a little bit about yourself, Keely.
Well, I'm an architectural visualization artist now,
mm-hmm.
and I was an architect.
Yeah.
And then a visual effects artist.
Your talk yesterday was amazing, because you've had all this meandering path.
Yeah.
You dropped out of school a couple times.
Mm-hmm. A couple times.
Listen, dropping out of school is fine if you're successful, and you are. So I wouldn't worry about it. But
you
work for Rem Koolhaas. Mm-hmm. You went to work for Bruce Mouse. So you were talking architecture, graphic mm-hmm. design, and then you went to work and do some previs over at PLF, which is a fantastic company.
Yeah, they're awesome.
So so tell us a little bit about how that happened and why your decision to go. What I'm curious is that decision to go from PLF and start your own archivist company.
I think like a lot of things when you're in a creative field, a lot of decisions aren't necessarily deliberate. Mm-hmm. So you are enjoying creating, and I think that's what this conference is about.
Right.
And you search for different ways to express what it is that you're interested in. And for me, it was always about how to get back to, you know, the sort of essential idea of what architecture is to me.
Right.
So it's somewhat personal. And was really motivated by everything that visual effects does to engage people, to excite them, and how we could bring some of that to architectural visualization, which at the time was relatively new.
Yeah.
So, and Lon, I know you guys have that story about the animation, the animated path, the cart.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's very true. So how can you bring excitement to architectural animation? And I felt like there was something there.
And where do you think that your time over at PLF really helped you? Like, for example, with cameras, obviously.
Massive.
Right?
Just massively. Right. I learned kind of everything that I know. I think, as you guys both mentioned, it's a tech-first field in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And, I mean, things about pipeline, even the proper way to set up a scene, it all began for me there.
Right.
And I think some of those lessons of large visual effects studios carry over to what we're doing. And it's a relatively new field, you know, in architectural visualization. So there's a lot we can learn from everything.
Right. I think you're right. I think it's really cool that field helped you with your ArcViz concept. But do you feel that the architecture visualization or even the concept of architecture could... pure architecture, not just I like buildings.
Yeah, sure.
Really help the concept artists and the designers that are doing stuff here.
I absolutely do.
Right.
And I've been very fortunate to have a number of conversations with these amazing artists, and some of them work on characters, which is outside of my experience and I'm fascinated by. But many of them will admit, you know, I draw on a white background, or I'm not necessarily thinking about what this character is doing. And there are also a lot of talented environment designers, but I think there's definitely something that the observation of what happens to you when you're in a space can help with motivation of characters and perhaps with even the way that they're conceived.
I'm almost thinking, you know, because of, you know, we all have, we know architecture really well, right? But it's, people draw environments, people draw buildings, mm-hmm. people draw stuff, but no one's looking at, like, you know, Corbusier mm-hmm. as an inspiration of a building when they're doing concept art. No one's looking at Mies van der Rohe or even Rem Koolhaas or Jean Nouvel or anything. Those are incredible pieces of architecture mm-hmm. that I think could serve the community more, because it seems like that just sort of stays within the architect's portfolio.
Well, I think that's a really interesting point, because when you look at, for instance, actual filmmaking, mm-hmm. Live filmmaking, there are so many significant buildings that are used, particularly in Los Angeles. I think Morphosis is a great example.
Right.
Caltrans building.
Yeah.
Even The Cell was filmed at the high school, Diamond Ranch. And in a sense, that's something that filmmakers know. You know, you need this great environment because it motivates actions and it motivates sequences. But I feel as though somehow in visual effects at some point, maybe it's not completely, or even in games, I think right now games, it's something that's being discovered more,
mm-hmm.
That the environment is so crucial and that maybe we can look to architecture.
Yeah, I think that we have that's kind of one of the things that I wanted to do this year, and you and I were talking about it, Jeff. About coming to THU is trying to bring that message here and try to see what we can do. But what's also cool is that there's been, what, about 100 or so people from the architecture
like
field that we can do?
Something like that,
Yeah.
It's interesting because, I mean, we spoke about this last year, but we wanted to get the people at the top of our industry who really appreciate the cross-pollination between different, you know, 3D fields and artistic fields,
right,
and have them come here. And yeah, I mean, I don't think I've spoken to one yet this year who hasn't been absolutely blown away. So
right.
I think it's mission accomplished in that sense.
Yeah, we've had a lot of great positive feedback, which is great. So hopefully this will. I've been telling them, it's like, great, spread the word, let people know about this, because I think we can have a lot of great conversations with those people. And again, I think that we should find a way that we can engage other people to do things, right? So so what do you guys think about the role of the ArcVis community? Like, what has changed in the ArcVis community that sort of made it a little bit more stale, besides just talking about technology?
I mean, I would say certainly the industry started very stale. I mean, I think because most of the people in the industry were technicians.
Mm-hmm.
And as, you know, the technology matured and people kind of got past the novelty of the technology.
Right.
This is a conversation that's happened, you know, for the last 10 years. But I think once people got past that and it was then about the creativity, we started to see the kind of upward trajectory of that. And now I think the top people in our industry are very much about, you know, how do you evoke an emotion, you know, convey a story within an image or a film. And it's not about the technology. I mean, certainly for now, we're bound by those technologies as a tool. But, you know, I think the people that came to THU, they fully understand the, you know, the...
Yeah, I was talking to Pedro yesterday, and he was definitely like... I mean, his work is inspired by matte painting, right? So
right.
He does more of a matte painting than he does an actual rendering.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I think you and I talked about a couple of years ago, Jeff, about the fact that photorealistic rendering is almost a solved problem, right?
Yeah.
So we don't have to worry about that anymore. It's not like my thing looks really real. It's like, no, it's going to look real. It can pretty much look real out of the box now.
I think we're going into like an opposite direction of that now. I think, you know, there's a place for photoreal,
right?
But I think a lot of the work that we're seeing that is the kind of the top of our industry is the stuff that is hand painted and matte painted.
But even your work, you've got a style to your Kilograph's work is not about photorealism in the same way at all.
It's not, but we're doing some more photorealism, and I think I actually watched a talk that Daniel Flood gave a couple of years ago, who is the owner of Flood Slicer in Australia, and he had some really interesting points about, you know, how we're pursuing photorealism maybe to the detriment, but there's something else that we do that it's interesting to observe. It's the way some of these artists talk about their work. We are mostly architects, or at least we've dealt in the creation of an environment for so long, that the way that we stage a scene, the way that we art direct, is very unique to architectural visualization.
Okay.
So we're able to conceive of an entire story, and if that happens to be articulated in a photorealistic way, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But we understand completely the story that sort of scenography conveys.
Right.
And I think there's a role there, because a lot of people need to see what something's going to be.
Right.
I feel like that probably goes back to the roots of architecture, because in its essence, architecture is about experiencing a space. And if you understand how to design something that evokes emotion in a physical space, then you can do that in an image as well.
Exactly.
But don't you think it's interesting? Let's talk about the actual story, right? The story of architecture, or when you were in architecture, how do you tell a story? I was very obsessed with the concept of narrative in architecture. When I was in architecture school, I thought that's what I wanted to talk about. But the narrative that happens when you look at architecture is very different, right? Mm-hmm. It's not linear.
No.
It's sort of ambient in a way, right? And so when you in architecture school or working for an architecture office and you're designing something, you have to present that.
Yes.
Right? So when you present that, you're telling a story.
Yes.
And so that concept of architecture narrative is very different. So what are your thoughts on architecture narrative?
Well, I think, I saw an interesting talk a couple of days ago that Luger gave. And he had a whole concept of spatial narrative, and I felt like that's it. I mean, that's the way that we think about architecture.
Right.
We sometimes try to force these linear narratives into what we're doing, when in reality we're thinking all around us all the time, and that goes back to this idea that VR is the kind of perfect perfect medium for the way that we think of space. The story
you're already going exactly where I'm going.
Yeah,
that's
sorry.
Exactly
what
you just
totally
jumped right in there.
No,
I was going to control the conversation, but you can do it. No, it's fine. No, you're right, because VR is, that's my point, is that basically filmmaking, right, is a third person experience. Mm-hmm. And architecture is a first-person experience.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so VR is a first-person experience.
Yes.
But the problem is people are just, what Ludger was telling me, and I was talking about it with him over at the, you know, at the Oasis yesterday. We hung out for a while. He's such a cool guy. Such a cool guy. But he was telling me, he's like, people are just looking at VR and thinking it's an extension of 3D film. I was like, and he says, that's completely the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. So you're right, spatial narrative, right? So, and that's architecture.
It is.
And in VR, you pretty much should be looking at architecture, not just some random stuff with some characters in it.
It can be motivated. I think we have a super talented team in our office who are developing our VR, and they're really enthusiastic. And they have a lot of ideas around how you're motivated in a space, you know, how the interaction happens.
Right.
And the feedback that you might get. And I think there's some really exciting stuff going on there that's completely related to what we're all doing. Even those of us who are perhaps practicing architectural visualization as more of a high art form,
like
the artists. And, I mean, this conference, I mean, we talked about this today when we were having coffee. You can almost replace the word artist with entrepreneur or architect. It's also relevant.
Right. I think it's really great because Scott and Andre and I did my first interview with them at the opening day, and they came over here and they said that they did not think of architecture as relevant to this conference until I convinced them as such. That's what happened, right? So we convinced them to do that. They said it's not necessarily relevant, and then you convinced us, and then that's where they said it's not about concept art. It's about experiences, and it's about creativity. And we all have a role to play, and we can all contribute together. So I think that's important. What are some of your another secret thing that architects tend to have is they're complete movie buffs in a lot of ways. What are some of your favorite movies that have inspired you in architecture? Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I hate to be predictable, but Blade Runner. So, you know, like massively.
Uh-huh.
I go to that Bradbury building frequently. I think when I was in school, it was all about Tarkovsky.
Uh-huh.
You know, just different ways of looking at how drama is laid out, sort of cinematography, and different ways that can be shot. I mean, you can really find it in anything.
Right.
It's,
But I also thought it was really interesting. It was part of your presentation yesterday. You talked about watching Minority Report.
Oh, yeah, right.
Tell your Minority Report story.
I mean, I don't know if it's the best film out there. But
no.
But
it made you realize something.
It did. It really made me realize that there's this role for architecture as conceiving of the future of cities.
Right.
And then that can be articulated in such an incredibly visual way. And finding out the story of Minority Report, how they had futurists actually consulting on that film, on what the future of highways would look like and transportation. And it comes through.
Right.
But it was a really huge aha moment that, we can do this too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can make something come to life.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, you know, when I was in architecture school, I loved the Italian futurists' architecture, right? They're amazing, but they look like things that would go in a sci-fi film,
completely.
Even though they were designed in the 1920s.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So there's a lot of interesting ideas that go on there and a lot of influences. Actually, one of my favorite architectural influence films are the Jacques Tati films, like
Yes, we love those. I mean, we're just sending those around in the studio to each other.
They're so funny,
so awesome, beautiful.
So funny. Have you ever seen these films? They basically make fun of They basically make fun of modernism, like modernist architecture, to like the extreme.
Yeah,
and these very
Playtime is my favorite.
Playtime is really funny. So yeah,
it's pretty awesome.
But there is influences as well. And I want to bring up a controversial one, because you also brought up 12 Monkeys.
Yes, and I showed the picture, but I didn't say anything.
You didn't say, why didn't you say anything about it?
I think, well, I talked to my husband, who's an architect, and he was like, maybe just don't say that one.
Do it on the live broadcast.
Yeah, I'll do it on the live broadcast. well, Lebius Woods, who's a really, who was a very, very talented architect illustrator,
right,
had done a drawing of had done a scene, and it was so inspirational.
He does architectural illustration.
Yes, he does architectural.
And he does a lot of very futuristic,
exactly,
looking illustrations, yeah, of things that are amazing. So look up Lebius,
yes,
Woods.
Yeah. Yes, and he's a big inspiration for a lot of the architects that we love.
Right.
And Terry Gilliam,
right,
I guess, was also a big fan. And I hope I don't get sued or anything for saying that.
No.
It already happened the last
time. It already happened. Everyone's talked about it.
Okay. and so he basically ripped off exactly the drawing. And I showed it in the lecture. It's even the framing is,
right,
exactly the same,
so
with the chair.
The chair that's elevated, and then he's in the chair that's elevated. It's the same framing, same
exactly
chair.
Exactly the same. And then the way it rolled out was that that he sued Universal.
There was a settlement. There was a settlement that happened.
And he decided to not...
And he didn't know about it until he just went to the movies to see this movie. And he,
right,
says, what the hell? That's my drawing.
And when there's a lot of discussion about whether it was deliberate that he wanted it to be out there in the world,
right,
you know, instead of having them take it out, because he had the right to say, cut that out of the film.
Right.
But he said, leave it. Or maybe he just wanted the money.
Well, it's not fair, right? I mean, we were discussing earlier, there's a lot of problems with people that are trying to rip off your mm-hmm. work and stuff. But you can call it inspiration,
yeah,
sometimes, or sometimes you can say you just ripped me off.
It's, right? It's interesting. I think that legal side of, you know, of what happens as an artist, you don't protect your creation maybe in the same way, or you don't think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard lots of discussions, even the B-sides that we were in.
Yeah.
With Shuzo, mm-hmm. John Shioda, mm-hmm. about they created a penguin that went on to get royalties.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Which was sort of an interesting concept.
Oh, they created a character.
Yes.
But then someone else owned the IP of it, right?
They owned it.
They owned
retained
it.
It was kind of a genius move.
Yeah, interesting.
And it's still getting royalties 35 years later.
Wow.
Yeah.
I want to create something that still gets royalties.
Right?
Yeah.
I think our industry, like, really, and maybe it's because most people have an architectural background and not a business background, but most people don't think about the work they create in our industry as IP.
No.
It's something a client commissions and it doesn't belong to them anymore.
Right.
Exactly.
So I think we have a lot of problems in our industry with
I
that.
Do, and I love the series that you're doing in CG Architect about the business.
Yeah, it's something that I think has been missing. The people, you know, really experienced people that have built their businesses for 15, 20 years,
mm-hmm.
you know, talking about their challenges and how they structure their businesses,
mm-hmm.
and all of the things they've learned over time.
That's
well,
really
just if you go back and listen to my Norman Seif podcast, I did a few years ago, but you know what? He actually holds the rights to every photograph that he takes.
Oh, wow.
Right? Even if you commission him to do something, he says, great, but I still own the rights. Yeah. You still have to license it from me.
I think photography is an excellent model.
Yes.
I think we should be following that model in our own industry.
We should be following that model,
yeah.
right? And, you know, photographers aren't necessarily very rich people.
Yeah.
We should also admit that. But it is a model that we should look at, right? So we're creating content. We're creating stuff. And it's not just stuff that can be shared. You know, the problem is, it's like, it's on Facebook. Why? It's free, right?
Right.
It's like, nope.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. All right, well, we're getting towards the end here, but I want to let people know a little bit where they can follow your work or see what you're doing. Obviously, I've known you when you started CG Architect, right?
Yeah, 2001, yeah.
2001, so cgarchitect.com is the sort of place to see a lot of stuff that's going on in that field. And besides, obviously, news about ArcViz, what other stuff can you find on CG Architect?
Yes, I mean, we have a huge gallery, I think about 70,000 images that have, you know, we've been collecting for the last 16 years, so we get hundreds of those every month, and we have a community on our forums, and I think the biggest thing that I'm most proud of is our 3D awards that we do every year. This was our 14th year, and you know, we get people to submit from all over the world. We usually get around 4,000 submissions, and you know, we recognize the top people in our industry, students and professionals, and people of all walks of life in our industry, so I think that's the best.
It's a really great award, and I remember it's been going on for quite a while now.
14 years.
14 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a great run, absolutely. And what about you, Keely? Where can they find more information and some of the examples of the awesome company you've founded?
Kilograph.com.
Mm-hmm.
Just plugging that.
Yeah. Besides, you know, obviously some amazing stills that you've done and some videos that you've done, you've also done some really interesting experimental work in AR that I don't even want to call it experimental because it just seems logical. Like, wow, that what a great idea of a use for AR and VR stuff. So,
well, I have a very talented team.
So yeah, you do have good, awesome work. A good, great team. So really appreciate it. All right, thanks a lot,
guys. Thank
you, Chris. Thanks, Chris.
Hopefully you guys enjoyed the first part of the podcast with Keely and Jeff. It was a lot of fun catching up with them. And now we go on to part two of the podcast with Jessica Rutsevich.
I've got Jessica here. Jessica, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. I've been hanging out with you all week, and I've been talking a lot about stuff, and I had this great idea that you should be my last guest.
Brilliant. Brilliant. It must have been the rosé.
But lots of rosé was involved. But it's very. I think you bring something very interesting to the table that people would be interested in finding out about. Tell them a little bit about what you do.
What I currently do. Okay. So I am what's known as an experience designer. So I've been doing a lot of explanation here. That was unnecessary because I think a lot of people here know what it is. But I started doing it at a point at which it was not a known thing. And
right.
I was working with a lot of designers and artists to make websites.
Right.
And I was a producer for that. And what I realized is that we were designing things for ways that humans don't consume them. Like all our designers had giant screens, yet the people who went to movie websites had little screens.
Right.
So what I did was try to help these designers, like by drawing out the schematics of the way my little sister or my mom might experience their website. And I had these crappy little drawings, and they're like, you know what you are? You're an information architect.
You're an information architect.
That's what the term was for experience design back in the mid-2000s.
Okay.
So I just started doing that, and it became a more formalized role.
Right.
I was so bad at it that like I couldn't even draw a box using a box tool correctly.
Right.
But it really was about like letting design shine and not letting technology and technological handicaps get in the way of people experiencing the design that these designers wanted.
So you see, this is exactly why you were wondering why would I want to talk to you? Because you're exactly that bridge that can bridge technology and design.
And I've met so many neat people here, like video game designers, motion designers, even like I'm noticing illustrators are beginning to add a little bit of interactivity into their work, and that's where I come in now.
Okay. But I mean, so really, you call it experience designer, but really, everyone's been using UI for a while, and then suddenly about 5-6 years ago, everyone started using the term UX,
So
instead of user interface, it's user experience, right? So what do you think the difference is? Where is that bridge where it used to be UI and now it's called UX? So where is that connection or difference?
Well, so initially, like when I started, it was almost a library science. It is how do you present information, whether it's visual information or text-based information, to a person in a way that they can consume and identify with.
Okay.
So then it went into this like, we need to pay attention to the UI of products. Like designers didn't have a seat at the table in these major corporations. The engineers did. So then they're like, all right, we can program the thing, but we now recognize we're not the best people to put a face upon it.
Okay.
And that's where it started becoming UI.
Mm-hmm.
And then after UI, I'm not the most talented UI designer. I barely consider myself one. It's the experience of like, I go to people's houses and I watch, like I see the way they touch things and the way they hold things.
Okay.
And I use that as a science to help UI designers make decisions about the UI. So UX is more like the whole system. Like when you go to a theme park and you have a magic badge, what does that mean for you as you move from point to point to point?
Okay.
And then I'll work with UI designers and motion designers to kind of make it seamless. Like UI is now just one little picture.
UI is just a portion of what the experience is, right?
Yep.
But it's also a flow, right? There's something about the flow that's important. And we were talking earlier about how my friend's girl is like, it needs to be so intuitive that there's no instructions.
Yep. And it's happening with invisible interfaces now. Like, right. You've got Alexas, you've got, like, driving voice navigations, and right. they don't always have a visual expression.
Right.
So how do you figure out how somebody interacts with a creative thing and a digital thing using only voice?
Voice.
And right. they're figuring out it doesn't work too well. Like,
right.
It's coming, like, that's why Amazon now has that Amazon Show and right. like other things, because
you need an extra layer.
You do. Without visuals, it's very linear, but people aren't linear creatures. We kind of like to abstract things, and the way a child asks Alexa a thing is so different than a granny.
Right.
Like,
well, it's also interesting to me is, and it's a little bit of a side note, but just let's talk about the voice for a second. When you say something to Alexa, let's uh-huh. say, or to, you know, Siri or Google Now or whatever, you get one answer.
Yes.
As opposed to a choice of answers.
Yes.
Which is also interesting, because pretty much like we basically have to trust that it's the right answer, because before people complained that people only click on the first page of a Google search, but that's 10 answers.
Yep. Yep. And you're not going to know how to go backwards. Like, do you say, Alexa, go backwards?
Right.
Like, and all and the answers.
Because that just makes it longer and pointless.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Like, and it's such a trickery, like, slippery slope right. to navigate. But I was hanging out with, she's from China. I had an intern this summer. Mm-hmm. And she taught me about the Chinese Alexa, oh. that's so much smarter. And it does.
Okay, explain that, please.
So it has this visual interface, right? Yeah. And it greets you when you enter the room. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting that Alexa and other interfaces here don't do yet is recognize who you are and adjust themselves visually to match who you are. So I forgot what it's called. It's in English, it translates to little fish, little fish.
Okay.
So you walk in and instead of Alexa, you're like, little fish, little fish.
Okay.
And then it's visual display, if you're a child, will increase. The font size gets big and it uses simple words. Same thing if an elderly person does it. And if you're maybe somebody like me who can read at a distance, it's snappier with its information.
Interesting.
Like, it's leagues ahead.
Wow.
Of where we are.
And who's making this?
I don't know. I know it's, like, if you knew the Chinese term for little fish, little fish.
Okay.
That's something I'm going to have to look up.
Okay. But let's go back to the idea of interface, right? Uh-huh. Of the idea of how you operate. The example I was given is, like, you know, when you buy your new iPhone, it doesn't come with instructions.
Nope.
You don't need them, right? And when you download an app, it doesn't have to be iPhone, it could be Android, whatever, but you buy a new app, and that doesn't come with instructions. Nothing comes with instructions anymore. They're not needed. So people have gotten much, much better at... So here's my question, actually. Are people just... Is there just a set of rules that people have come to accept? Or are we just designing interfaces that are much more intuitive in general?
Oh, interesting. I guess it's a combination of both, right? Like, the first time you've ever assembled a piece of IKEA furniture,
right.
you've probably like, but it follows its own design rules and design paradigms. You know, you've got that squeaky thing that you kind of crank, and you know you need certain jiggers in the jagger, and it might be completely uneven until you tighten it.
Right.
It's that kind of thing. I don't know if everybody knew how to use an iPhone the second it came out, which was, I think, 2008?
2007.
Or so, you know, like, you know, it was as friendly as it could possibly be, but there is this kind of acquired information and assumption you make,
right?
Which Apple, very in the beginning, they remember when you went to go look at their periodicals, they looked like newspapers on a shelf. So they created this, like, bridge moments in their interfaces to help us cavemen connect with what we were trying to actually do.
Yeah, and then also they... It was interesting because I think his name is Duarte something. He's the main designer behind the Android interface, right? And then that sort of leapfrogged the Apple one, and then Apple adjusted, and all of a sudden, like, the way things worked started to sort of become this very clean, like clean interfaces are very popular.
Oh, right? yeah. And I think Samsung was one of the first people to do that
right.
on the Android sense. Like, I was an Android
That was actually
beginning.
Put, to, well, it, Samsung wasn't the one. It was actually guidelines by Android to set this up.
And they called it
They called it material design.
Yes. And Samsung was a thing. They just took it quite seriously.
They did.
Whereas
yeah.
everybody else was like,
I know, everything looked like bubbly gook and stuff like that.
Yeah. And Android, to a degree, is still a slightly, or was a slightly different audience in that they were more technical, and technical people
sure.
want more power. They
yeah.
want to see the stuff that people like me don't want to see.
Right.
They want to see kind of the sausage making and make the VPN style like decisions that
right.
they want to make, whereas, you know, my mom, myself, don't.
Right. What about... what about just your general idea of software? Like, when you design software, what are some of the guidelines? If I say, okay, I've got an application that I want to write, and if I go to someone like you, how would you help me with those rules, for example?
Well, one of the first things I do is, obviously, I work with brilliant researchers. We
sure.
go hang out in people's houses and ask them how they currently do stuff, because
okay.
we tend to try to create stuff that hasn't existed before, like
sure.
weird things, like, I mean, chatbots are the thing of the day, like,
right.
but, you know, like a chatbot that helps somebody deal with diabetes
okay.
and stuff like that. But we just research how people currently do stuff and try to emulate that as much as possible. Like,
right.
creating a new habit is pushing water uphill.
Okay.
Like, it's, you're not going to get it done quite easily.
Right.
So meet with them. And then also, like, a part
of... So what do you mean by creating a new habit? Like, in the sense that... You want to teach someone a new habit, or you want to use their existing...
You want to use their existing habits to kind of, like, parlay into a new thing
right.
you want to use. You want
so
them
intuitive
to
is based on old habits.
Very much.
Right.
Very, very much.
Right.
And, like, they'll learn it if it's, like, super valuable. Like, we used to order taxis.
Right.
The Uber was a strange thing, or Airbnb staying in a stranger's house was a strange
right.
thing.
Right.
But now that we have it, if it gets taken away, we're like, rabble, rabble, rabble.
Right.
Like, it's disappeared, because that new habit took no time to create.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like the Uber experience was an interesting one, too, because it took on something that was so fundamentally... like ingrained in us about
yeah.
having a taxi and how much it costs
mm-hmm.
and everything, and it simplified so much on also made it cheaper.
Yep.
And then it had to adjust itself as we went along and added more features, but generally, yeah, you're right. It was like I opened Uber.
Yep.
And it was very straightforward on how to use it.
Like, the best interface, like, I know I succeeded at my job if nobody talks about my interface. Like, whoever sits there and talks about the Uber interface or the Airbnb, like, we sweat over this stuff.
Right.
But, you know, you did
so
a good job.
So you're just like a visual effects person. And I'll
Is
tell you
that
why.
True?
Well, a visual effects person says, if no one notices that it's a visual effects, then they've done an amazing job.
That's it. For, like, they're there to get what you promise them.
Right.
In the end of what the product you're creating. If they're noticing they're using an interface to do it,
right.
you've kind of done something wrong there. Like, that
yes.
they have to think about it.
What was
it?
The quote I heard, and I guess it's an old quote, but I heard it for the first time, is if you have to explain the interface, interfaces are like jokes. If you have to explain them, then they're not very good.
Or it takes you like 5 seconds to get, and it's like,
it's like, what am I doing?
Yeah. Yeah, very, very much so. So there, yeah, that's what I try to do. And another piece of interface design is not just the user, but the company who launches it. How easy is it to maintain?
Right.
How easy is Uber for drivers to use?
Right.
So that's where you kind of get into this like whole systems thinking. Like, how many assets do they need to create? And when and how do they integrate them? Is all stuff that goes into...
So what I've noticed, okay, if I'm going to go into video games for a little bit. So I had a chat with a friend of mine who works at Naughty Dog. He's actually one of the writers at Naughty Dog.
Uh-huh.
He's a great guy. And we were talking about the idea that, you know, when you had a video game back in the day, it actually used to come with instructions on what the buttons were to do what
yeah.
and everything else. And sometimes in some video games, they still come up with, like, the picture of the controller of all, and you have to, like, what's
oh,
the
horrible.
Thing for that?
Uh-huh.
What's that? And so they are designing a level inside video games now, which teaches you the game as part of the story.
And Twitter did that when Twitter first launched.
Did they?
Yeah.
How did they do that? Tell me about the Twitter experience.
So they had, like, there was this window, and even in the field, it's like, what are you up to today? I think it said something like that.
Okay.
So even the form label told you what to do. But it had just these, like, the setup process actually made you do something during it that proved the concept of Twitter. And by the time you're done setting up, you've kind of almost already
used Twitter.
Tweeted.
Right. But that, I think that's the way that people think of, like, if they're going to design a video game or do a video game, to think about that process, right?
Yeah.
To think about how it works and not to make it boring.
Right.
Because the I'm talking about video games because there are a lot of people who work in video games who are here.
Which I love games.
Yeah.
Absolutely do.
But, like, I played Uncharted, right?
Uh-huh.
Or Uncharted 4, which was written by Josh, actually, my friend Josh. So he was talking specifically about, you know, I was telling him that the intro or the tutorial of the game was actually like the backstory of the main character. So you got to know the backstory of the character by going through him as a kid. So you got to, as a kid, as he was learning to become the person, you were learning to do the moves or whatever it happened to be.
Yes. It kind of reminds me of Fable.
Fable?
If you've ever played Fable.
No, tell me about Fable.
Similar kind of thing. You have your companion dog, and because, you know, who doesn't like a companion dog?
Sure.
Like, you just learn how to use it because of some sort of emotional investment in making it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you kind of move the controllers is absolutely intuitive with the way it should work.
Right.
Like, Rory bought the Vive.
Oh, yeah?
So, yeah, we have one at home, and there's a bow and arrow game. And, you know, it's like a part of the demo. But your hand, actually, the controller starts shaking
as
the
you go
further
right.
you pull back.
Right.
Like, that's no explanation needed. No manual ever, like, described to you that
right.
your hand will start shaking. It just happens.
Yeah, no, that's a great example. That's a great example. Well, what are some of the other examples that you can think of experience designs that are really interesting, that could be interesting to some people to just know about?
Man, well, I think a lot of people are. What I'm really interested in now is designing for, like, kind of the augmented virtual reality. I think a lot of designers of my age are super interested in that. Like, back, I started designing 2005,
mm-hmm.
and then it was, like, mobile for a while. And now this is kind of the new horizon for us.
Yeah, and it's extraordinarily important.
And there are applications from healthcare to entertainment, like in VR, for example. Like burn victims, they've done experiments with burn victims
mm-hmm.
that you put on a VR headset and you just look at ice. You look at pictures of the North Pole, and it actually resulted in a reduction of perceived pain, which resulted in a reduction of the necessity for drugs, which resulted in in less, perhaps, over time, addiction to those drugs and the recovery from those drugs.
Wow.
VR did that.
That's amazing.
So I actually am so fascinated to be here because there are so many designers who I will put my money on that I will be working with in 10 years, 5
right.
years. Like, that will be this new way.
Well, I think that's been a subject that actually has come up a few times in this in on these series of talks that I've done here where the interface of VR is a confusing, like, no one really knows what that's going to be like. The controllers are you know, you're used to the keyboard and the mouse, right?
Yep.
And so that's another point is, like, you're so used to keyboard and mouse. Like, if I'm playing a video game, I already know that ASW, you know, like, I can, you know, like, I know where to put my fingers to play any video game, even though I've never played it.
Yep.
Now, that's a learned experience.
Absolutely.
Right? But with VR, you're like, you got these controllers, and, you know, it's pretty good. They do a pretty good job of showing you the controllers in front of you. But you don't really know what they can do yet. And you don't need, like, we're so used to the windowed experience that we, like, when you can surround your world with it, I don't know what are you predicting that interface is going to look like?
Well, so I love watching whenever people come over to our place
and
put on the Vive for the first time. That is, like,
so you probably observe
heaven.
How they try to use it.
They're not intuitive. Like Rory's like, no, you do it this way. Like there's a huge learning curve to these controllers for VR. I did read, and China once again doing awesome stuff, is because of the advent of 3D printing technology, and now Vive has that, I forgot what it's called now, but like a little piece that you can add on to any 3D object.
Oh, yes.
Like a baseball bat, right?
Yeah.
So,
and it'll track it.
Yeah, exactly. So we even haven't seen that very much in the US, but from what I understand, in China it's huge. Like, you want to ride a horse, they print a 3D horse that rocks to give you that full physicality of using it. Though, you know, it's not going to be available for every thing you do.
Okay. But have you tried the Oculus controllers?
No, I just got the ones that come for the Gear
Vive
VR.
The Vive ones are the ones that have a little circle on top of those. And those were the first ones that I used.
Is it this
good.
Little thumb pad one?
The other one is, you look at it, if you haven't seen it, we'll look it up later. But it's got a controller that when you look at it, it's like, this is completely unintuitive. But then when you put it on, it feels like your hands. It actually feels like your hands. And I don't know if it's the end solution, but it certainly seemed like a step forward in some ways. There is something about it that, like, when you hold it, and you're like, okay, you put it in your hand, and then you lift your finger from the thing, and you see a finger move. So it becomes very much more...
Oh, super neat.
Yeah, it becomes a little bit different.
Yeah.
And I'm not I'm not sure that's the right solution, but it seemed like a step forward. But the problem is, like, how do you type? How do you do this? You know.
And what about neural interfaces? Are we all going to have like controllers in our bags, or you know, like the little race cars you can run around now using your brain? Like we can sense some sort of on-off signal that your brain projects.
Yes.
So, and that's just recent. So where is that going to go? Like,
I don't know. I've got this thing about trying to figure out the proper interfaces for VR. What is that interface so that people can work? And I'm having a thing, but we don't have to keep going in VR.
But I guess, if it's a shooting game, you want to feel something that feels like a gun.
Sure.
But if it's not a thing that needs interface, let's say it's augmented reality, where let's say you can't hear, you're deaf, and it subtitles the world for you. You don't need an interface for that.
The interface just does the
job.
And I think there's a lot of VR experiences that don't need interfaces. But since you're an experience designer and not necessarily an interface designer, what do you think about the VR experience? What do you think the people are looking for when they actually try to experience VR? What would be the proper thing?
Well, like VR versus AR, from what I've observed and what I've felt, is full-on immersion. Like, take me into your world.
Right.
That's all it is. So, in a way, what you do with your hands might matter less because of the way you're kind of the story you're being told.
But you also see your real hands.
Oh, yes. Actually, I think that was a big problem in early VR, is the lack of hands and them not being your hands. And this helped add, perhaps, to like this unstable
sense of disembodiment, right?
Yeah, that's the perfect word for it, yeah.
Right.
But if you can see your feet, you look at your feet.
I heard that's another thing, that you're seeing your feet could actually help.
I think it was huge. And men and women in studies, and these studies go back to like the American military in the 40s, of how differently men and women experience VR.
Oh, yeah?
There was this test done on like people going through sex reassignment surgery who had tried VR before and afterwards, and they're grabbing doorknobs in a different way. They're experiencing nausea and dizziness in a different way.
Interesting.
And there's perhaps a hormonal difference in the way people like process this visual information. And that, we don't know this stuff yet. It's fairly new.
Okay.
But I'm sure the military does, because they've been doing this for like 60 years. But that's locked up in a, like under a mountain.
You think
somewhere.
The military knows about people going through sex changes? Yes. And I think there's a lot of, that's another thing that's really nice about VR, is the idea that you can experience things as a different person.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
There was a conversation about, I think Keely brought it up today when in her talk about having a VR application to experience architecture, but you're experiencing it as a child.
Yes, 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 yes.
And I've actually, you know, so there is a demo that you spoke about IKEA. So IKEA made a VR demo,
mm-hmm.
which is a really simple one. It's basically just an IKEA kitchen.
Yep.
And you get to operate, like you open the drawers, you get things, et cetera, et cetera. And there's an option in there to say, what if I'm 2 meters tall?
So
and then
cool.
suddenly, like, everything gets like, whoa, you realize the trouble of being 2 meters tall.
Right.
And then you experience it as a child and you realize the counters are like down here, right?
Yeah.
So suddenly, like, just from doing that experience, and I see my son, who's 7 years old, trying to pour himself a bowl of cereal and pour milk in it. It's not that he's clumsy. It's really hard.
Ooh.
Imagine doing this. You know,
uh-huh.
you're trying to, like,
yep.
pour some milk. That's hard.
Yeah,
and
that's 5 feet
I experienced
one.
That in the IKEA kitchen. I'm like, I am very sympathetic about him trying to pour
yeah.
milk, and he's going to learn it. But if he spills it, it's hard.
Yes, and that's it. When you said sympathetic, like, it builds an empathy that I don't
right.
know was possible quite before. You see it in, like, war reporting and, like, the IKEA thing. Like, I'm 5'1". I experience the world. I think I go up to your belly button. It's like when we stand next
I'm
to
a little
each
tall.
Other.
You're a little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit, like, VC, vertically challenged.
Yeah. But, like, a child lost in a crowd, I used to get lost all the time.
Right.
And maybe that's because I was a short child.
Right,
like,
right,
versus
right, right.
just. Scattered.
No, it's true, but it's like, it is a thing, right? And, like, experiencing things from different perspectives. Are different, but I think there. Here's what I liked about the IKEA demo
uh-huh.
that was different from other demos. A lot of other demos, there's something going wrong because I'm a tall guy,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm 6'3", which is about 185 or so. No, 195 or one or so in meters. I always feel like my feet are cut off.
What? Really?
Because I'm too tall.
Oh,
and so they designed the experience for someone a different height.
Yep.
But somehow the IKEA experience that I saw still made me feel like the ground was at the same distance, but everything was smaller or bigger around me.
Did you see your feet or no?
No, I didn't see my feet.
Oh, interesting.
But I could still experience it that way. So there's a technical way of making it happen that's a little bit of a challenge.
Yeah, there's so many unknowns in this world of, like, just simple things like height or the frame rate and the confusion that might cost or... I don't know, like, it's kind of interesting, the unexplored nature of it. Like, if anybody told you they have the answer, they're liars, they don't. We're kind of just messing around as we go.
Yeah. Well, we're getting towards the end here,
oh,
but I want to make sure that did go fast.
Yeah, it did.
Was it fun?
Yeah, it's really fun.
Okay, good, I'm glad you had fun, but... Can people get in touch with you or find out more about your work or anything else? Or where's a good place
man.
To get in touch?
Well, I don't tweet. I have a Twitter that I don't use.
Yeah.
LinkedIn.
Do you,
is
LinkedIn?
Probably the most.
Okay,
yeah.
So how do you spell your name?
Oh, ready?
Okay.
So I feel very at home in Europe because my last name is all consonants, but it's Jessica, and last name is R-U-D as in dog, Z as in zebra, E-W-I-C-Z, Jessica
Rutsevic. Very Polish.
I know, very Polish. I'm like totally at home here. Like,
awesome.
Yeah, I'm married to Rory, and he's like, change your name. I'm like, but then I'll be a Robinson.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
Jessica Robinson.
Like,
yeah.
I don't know if I can make that leap that quickly.
Okay, well, that sounds good. All right, well, thanks so much, Jessica.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.